Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Creative control, creative control. Comedy, art, and sometimes rock and roll. Let's do a public opinion poll. Raise your hand if you love creative control. 'Cause when Vish is unleashed, well you... Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. I was just working on a tribute song to my favorite podcast, Creative Control, with Vish Khanna. My name is Matthias, and I play in a band called The Burning Hell, but more importantly, I support Creative Control on Patreon, and I think you should too. Quality long-form arts journalism is like a magical talking unicorn. It definitely exists, but it can be really hard to find. Fortunately for us, Vish makes it easy with hundreds of funny, thought-provoking, well-researched, and engaging interviews with artists from all over the world. Your flexible monthly donation on Patreon will get you plenty of special exclusive treats and help Vish keep his podcast well-fed and cared for properly, the way a magical unicorn deserves.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Mark Masters is a respected music journalist who is currently based in the state of Arizona. An active presence over the past two decades, Masters has written for a host of publications, including The Washington Post, NPR, Pitchfork, The Village Voice, Wire, Bandcamp Daily, and the Washington City Paper, among others. His first book, No Wave, covered the history of that genre and was published in 2007. And he started and still hosts the Music Book Podcast. His latest work is a fascinating music book of his own called High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape, which was published by the University of North Carolina Press on October 3rd, 2023. As such, Mark and I, who've admired each other's work from afar, finally had a chance to have a talk, and we covered things like the state of physical media in a melting world, why music fans seem to fixate on old and new formats, what prompted him to explore the history and persistence of the cassette tape, its socio-political and democratizing properties, how it completely altered music listening and music making forever, how different parts of the world still revere and engage with cassette tapes, even as new technologies make it seemingly obsolete, tapers, the Grateful Dead, and Sonic Youth, how modern music portability and on-demand streaming stem from cassettes, what might be the next big thing in music mediums, book tour dates, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary source of revenue. I can't thank the people who support this show on Patreon enough. If you're able to join them, please do, and visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. Thank you so much. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 813 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Mark Masters, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing, Vish?
I'm very well. It's nice to have you on the show. Where in the world are you today?
I am in Arizona in a town a little south of Phoenix called Gilbert.
Oh, nice. How long have you been there?
Just a couple years, actually. I moved here in 2021. I was an East Coaster for all of my life in the D.C. area, but we decided to pick up and move out here for a bunch of different kind of nebulous reasons, but we've enjoyed it so far. It's much, much hotter, and there's no winter, which we like. So,
do you like that as the world gets hotter and hotter? Does it get particularly hot there, or is it okay?
It was over 100 yesterday, 100 degrees Fahrenheit here yesterday. So yeah, it gets very hot, but and I mean, in the future, no, I think it's probably a terrible place to live in the future, but for the present, it has these really nice mild winters where we don't have to worry about rain or snow or anything. So we're taking advantage of that for now.
Good for you. I mean, as someone who collects media, I see in the background there, I see records. We're going to be talking about the cassette tapes, this wonderful book of yours. I can't wait to talk about it. But the climate, the climate impacting, sometimes I look at my record collection and I've got some box sets way up high and I'm like, oh, heat rises. That's probably a mistake. Should I have my really expensive box sets up high? But then if I put them low, I don't know what to do. Anyway, do you worry about your media in climate calamity when it's like super hot?
Yeah, no, it is a concern, especially because I've, of course, since we moved here, I've gotten so much more stuff that it's spilling over into the garage, and I can keep it in the garage for the winter, but I have to move it all back in the summer, which is not a lot of fun. At least we don't have floods here, so I know that's never going to happen to my stuff. So I've made that trade off. But yeah, there are times when I do wonder the stuff I've got sitting up high here, how hot it's getting.
Have you ever lost something to a flood? Any of your collections or anything like that?
I did not really a flood. I mean, in DC where we lived, I had all my office stuff was in the basement. And luckily it never actually flooded. We did have one time there was a problem with our AC unit that was housed down there, and I got some water on some stuff that I'd stupidly left on the floor, which was, you know, it wasn't a lot of stuff. It could have been a lot worse, but it was still, you know, a few box sets and things. It's still, those things are always traumatic. Even losing one piece of media to any kind of water is a traumatic experience.
Absolutely. I mean, well, you know, this is why people are going intangible, I guess. They want less physical stuff because it takes up space. It gets damaged. I don't know. But anyway, this seems like a nice enough segue to commend you on this wonderful book, High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape. I enjoyed this immensely. I will say for me, it mostly brought back a lot of memories. I moved from Ontario to Alberta, left my tape decks behind. We got a new vehicle when we moved here. It does not have a cassette deck in it. So I have all my tapes. And I see, as I want to buy stuff on Bandcamp or on people's websites, buy my cassette tape. There, you know, it's interesting to see that this thing has never died. And I'm curious about your interest to have such an interest in this phenomenon to write a book about tapes. So a swirl of things there. Let's get to this book. What inspired you in particular to write this particular book?
Well, it's an idea that had been kicking around for a while, mostly because, I mean, a combination of the two things you're talking about. I loved them growing up. I had a ton of them. I listened to them in my car. I listened to them on my double tape deck and dubbed them back and forth and things like that. So they always held a place for me. And I got rid of some of mine over the years, but I never really kind of completely abandoned them. But then there was a double thing of sort of what people think of as a resurgence. I mean, they never really went away, but in the last, you know, decade or so, a lot of the music I like on the smaller labels, those labels take advantage of the fact that it's so much cheaper and faster to make cassettes than it is to do vinyl at this point.
Yeah.
And it's not just that it's the convenience either. They've taken advantage of like the artistic possibilities of cassettes, the way that they can be packaged, the way they can be presented, the way music sounds on them and things like that. And so that combination, I felt like it was sort of a perfect time to kind of go through the history of how this all came to be, and sort of for people who are getting into them now who weren't there for when they came up, it hopefully will be interesting for those people. For people who have a lot of nostalgia for them, hopefully it'll be interesting to revisit that, and also to find out that they're very prominent still in a lot of ways that they might not know about.
By the end of the book, you break down some of the sales statistics about official cassette releases, blank tapes.
Mm-hmm.
You will admit, mm-hmm, it is quite a dramatic drop off from like 1997, oh, for sure. Where it's like, I can't remember all the figures, but like in the almost 100 million, yeah, cassettes are sold at one point, and now it's down to tens of thousands. So there, mm-hmm, is a smaller interest in the tapes, obviously, nowadays.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. What do you, but people are still manufacturing them, and particularly, mm-hmm, like I say, artists and labels. Did this happen with vinyl as well, do you think? Where with the advent of CDs, I feel like we are constantly talking about the format of music. Just always. Right. Like, it's just intrinsic in our obsession over music, is what format is the best, which is the purest. First of all, why do you think that is? Why are we always constantly like, oh, vinyl sounds better, cassettes sound better than CDs? Like, constant right, discussion. Why do you think that is?
That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, it's such a funny combination in music fandom and collecting, between all sorts of levels of how much do you care about the sound versus how much do you care about the music. But the sound and the music they are entwined. It's not like the music is this abstract thing that gets a production put on it or anything. So it's kind of hard to parse all those things out. Like for me, I've never really cared a ton about audio quality, and I can sort of tell the differences, but I like the differences. You know, it doesn't necessarily bother me that one thing sounds quote better than the other. It's sort of how you define better and things like that. The obsession with formats in general, yeah, that's, I don't know where that comes from exactly. It's always an interesting thing to talk about with people, because the major formats have enough differences that to me there's weaknesses and strengths with all of them that aren't duplicated across the line. I mean, you can pretty much pick out at least one or two unique strengths of each format that the others don't have,
yeah,
and unique weaknesses that the others don't have. And I'm not sure if that was ever by design, you know, with technology, with people inventing technology and industries kind of push technology. I think a lot of that is just based on what they think is going to sell, mm, and how they can sell records over and over again in different formats. But I think it's just been a neat kind of byproduct of these inventions that none of them have become the thing that you're like, well, this has everything right and nothing wrong about it. They all have both of those. And I think that makes it fascinating to talk about the differences between all of them.
I was born in 1977, so I grew up with cassette tapes. I grew up taping the songs I liked off of the radio. I grew up making myself, I did a few different things. I would go to the library and borrow the record or the CD of an album I liked, and then dub it. Like, I would tape it and I would make my own experiences. I would put an album on one side by, if I had a Nirvana tape, it was Bleach on one side, Nevermind on the other side, whatever. And I would just walk around with these things. And I just never really considered the socio-cultural implications of that access point, because I didn't know any different. I didn't know that there was a time where people couldn't, you know, show affection to someone by making them a mixtape. But it's interesting, in every advent of a new platform or format that we're discussing, there always seems to be some discussion of how it's democratizing music or democratizing the experience of music. Mm-hmm. And it always often seems to have a like, well, they've invented a thing and it's too expensive. None of us can afford a Walkman. It's too crazy. What is this? And then over time, it gets cheaper and cheaper and more accessible. It's just something I hadn't considered until reading your book. Do you think there's a sort of socio-political aspect to the music format discussion we were just having, that maybe we take it for granted that, you know, I'm buying records now, or I'm picking them up from the record store, and a single record is like $39, mm-hmm. and it makes no sense.
Yeah.
I don't know what trip it took yeah. to get to the store, but it's, I'm just like, this is 10 songs. Like, why is this $40? And the cassette,
right.
it's just a very strange time to follow the bouncing ball of format changes. But again, back to my question,
yeah.
do you feel like there's sociopolitical stuff here tied to each of these formats? And, I think you do based on the explorations in your book, but is that a significant part of how we're consuming music, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely the social and the social political is always hard to separate. So if it's there's social aspects, then there's definitely political aspects to it, too. I think the democratization is an interesting. I mean, I think there's ways to poke holes in that and say, did it really get to everybody? Did it really have did the cassette really have access? And like you said, it was expensive first. When it got cheaper, still, there were probably people that couldn't afford it or couldn't find it. And I don't think there's any like pure democratizing aspect of any format. There's still always complications there. But I think the interesting thing is one way to indicate that there is something that's putting some power into the hands of the people with the format is how the industry reacts.
Yeah.
And so the record industry, you know, that immediately freaked out about tapes. The fact that people were going to be able to tape their albums, control how they listen to their albums, remix songs, you know, tape songs off the radio, all that kind of stuff. Much the way you saw how they reacted to Napster later on, which,
absolutely.
You know, if you want to question whether it was democratizing, just see how they freaked out about that too. You know, so I think that aspect is definitely there's the industry kind of gatekeepers, if that's the right term, are always trying to make it so that they have the power and the way they control the way that people find music, how much they have to pay for it, how much, which way they listen to it. And so these formats in that sense do really have a big impact when they're offering the opportunity for people to change that and have sort of a say in it their own way. So in that sense, yeah, I think there are democratizing and social political aspects of all these things. I don't think they're always intended. I mean, I think the great thing about that is that they come from the people who use them rather than the people who make them. I don't think the guy that invented cassette tapes, Lou Ottens, was thinking this is going to change the world this is going to be power to the people. I'm sure it might have occurred to him. He was a smart guy, but I don't think that was his intention per se. It was more just like, wouldn't it be cool if you could take a real what people were using at the time, reel-to-reel tapes that could tape music or could tape records or whatever, and make it something that you could carry around that still sounded decent enough to use. You know,
interestingly, if according to your book, by the end of his life, Mr. Ottens was kind of decrying the supposed resurgence, doesn't he describe it as dangerous or something? I can't remember. But what did you when you came upon that? What did you think of that? The guy who invented it's like this is. Everyone's interested in it now. Like, what's the point? Like, that was the vibe I got. What did you make of that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think he was basically at heart an engineer more than he was a music guy, or he didn't even expect tapes were going to be used for music at first. He thought they weren't high quality enough, thought they'd be just for voice recordings. And so I think he was basically like, whatever's new and can make things better in whatever way, either convenience or cheaper or sound better, that's what he was always interested in. So the minute he and Phillips figured out that they could make digital audio that was affordable on CDs, I think he immediately stopped caring about tapes at that point. I mean, I'm sure he still cared somewhat, but he had no kind of romantic connection to any of the things he invented. He just thought, I'm always inventing things, I'm always pushing things forward. And I think that there's something kind of cool about the fact that he wasn't a proselytizer for it. It sort of allowed the proselytization to come from the people who really used and figured out ways to use the format that he had never really intended. And I don't think he really looked down per se on people who were still using them. I think he thought it was a little silly. Like, why would you when there's other better options out there from his perspective? But I also get the sense that I'm sure he was somewhat proud of that. He just wasn't willing to admit it because he was this forward-thinking guy all the time.
How would you characterize, I know there's all sorts of different examples of this in your book, but how would you characterize how the advent and widespread use of the cassette tape actually impacted musicians in particular? We were talking about democratization and access. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually have a fond memory of the first interview I can remember doing was with my mother on a cassette tape. And in retrospect, again, just taking it completely for granted that I could do that. It was for a grade 3 school project. And I just asked her about her life and we shared the tape recorder. I mean, arguably, that's how I got here. That's literally how she used to call me my media child, because I used to watch a lot of television, was interested in all these sorts of things. But in terms of musicians, can you characterize how you think the advent of the compact cassette actually impacted musicians who are, you know, trying to create things and capture them as quickly, as instinctually, I think, as possible? Can you speak to that?
Sure, sure. I mean, it's interesting because there are definitely some parallels between your experience and a lot of, like, Lou Barlow, who you've talked to before, who one of your interviews was very helpful to me for the book, actually. So that was awesome.
Thank you for quoting that interview in your book. That was really, sure. You know, it's weird. I'm making this little thing and it's starting to show up in people's books. And I'm like, wow, like,
that's
it's very flattering. Yeah. So I just want to, interject. I just want to thank you much. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, it's funny because we talked about me moving here to Arizona. I was listening to that episode as we were driving out here. My son and I were driving out here and I almost pulled over I was like, I got to remember that part because it was so perfect in terms of what I wanted him to talk about in my books.
Oh, nice. That's lovely.
That was awesome.
And also, thank you, Mark. You've been very supportive of the show generally and publicly. So thank you for listening. And it means a lot. So sorry, everyone. I didn't mean to interrupt Mark's flow there with the musician thing, but it means a lot. So sorry, please continue about.
Oh, cool. And I'll say really quickly, I mean, your show is completely inspiring. I mean, I love it and I love listening to it. I'm so psyched to be on it right now. And the whatever little bit of podcasting I've done has definitely been influenced by the way you conduct your interviews and the way you talk about music and stuff. So it's a huge inspiration.
Really, really. I can't thank you enough for saying that. You're too kind. Awesome. Thank you, Mark. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So Lou's experience was kind of like yours. Like his family kind of made each other audio letters on tapes, and they used to do little, you know, recordings for each other. And he got fascinated with putting his voice on tapes before he even knew he wanted to be a musician. But of course, that really super influenced the way he went about music, still goes about music. But it's sort of in the bigger picture in terms of artists and musicians using cassette tapes, there were a lot of ways that helped them and change the course of so many different genres, because number one, they could record on their own without having to pay for studio time, without having to put out the outlay of money that it takes, and also the connections it takes to get on a label or to have somebody promoting your music. They could just record it on a tape, dub it, and pass it around to their friends or send it to pen pals in the back of magazines and things like that. So that was helpful. And then also, I mean, the big example that I like the most in the book, although a lot of great examples, is hip hop. Because hip hop really would not exist, at least not the way we know it, without cassettes, because it was originally a DJ format before there were MCs, there were DJs, and you only could hear their mixes at parties unless you happen to know someone who would tape the mix that they made. And then eventually the DJs figured out, I'm going to tape the mix and sell it. And, you know, Grandmaster Flash was making a living selling these tapes.
Yeah.
You know, so not only was it a sort of a way for the music to get passed around and styles to influence, DJs were influencing each other by hearing each other's tapes. It was a way to go about, like, there wasn't really an idea that they could go to a record label and say, hey, can you put out one of my mixes so everybody can hear it or so that I can get more popular? I mean, it just wasn't a possibility. So this was a completely, you know, independent ecosystem, really, in a way of making the music develop. So by the time there was hip hop on record, like Rapper's Delight or whatever, the DJs themselves were way beyond that, because they had been trading tapes and trading styles so much that the music was evolving like crazy because of it.
That's a fascinating example in your book, because not only did some of these artists discover kind of the economic possibilities, like you could, because the tapes were so rare, you could sell one for $300 or something like that.
Right.
But then there was the personalization that would go on, shouting out questionable figures in the community so that the tape seemed more personalized. And that's a really fascinating aspect of how tapes became these communication tools in communities. One of the examples that actually stuck out for me of how musicians benefit from tapes, I think you maybe just alluded to demos and people recording themselves, but Lee Ranaldo becoming kind of a taper of his own band, Sonic Youth, I think is, maybe correct me if I'm wrong about this, but somebody, maybe at Lee's behest or others, decided they should record every Sonic Youth show and then listen back to them, I think on tour as they're going. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah.
They were making their own tapes, really taping the sets themselves and then listening in the van on the way to the next date and thinking about, should we be playing this that way, or should we be, you know, playing different songs or all that kind of stuff. Their music was evolving because of that. You know?
Yeah. So bands will often make demo tapes, demonstration recordings to just hear it back, like hear what they're, what it sounds like in a somewhat more objective manner, I suppose. Like, sure, you're in the room making the sound, but what did it actually sound like to others is an interesting, weird, experiential thing that musicians go through of like, oh, shit, I didn't know that was happening. I didn't realize that Lee did that because when I was when I did my first road managing stint 23 years ago, I was that guy. I would record. I had a little tape player and recorder that I brought with me, ostensibly to document the trip, along with, you know, a point and shoot camera. I did that. I was the road manager, and I documented the whole trip, and I taped every show. And if the band were up it, as we moved from city to city, I would play this sort of garbled, grainy sounding thing. Right? It didn't sound great. It didn't sound amazing, but it was like a reference. So the notion that musicians could actually, before they piled into an expensive studio, could actually give themselves their own reference. Is there any way to sort of underplay how significant that aspect of the creative process has been for musicians? I don't think so. What do you think?
No. Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, it was sort of the first opportunity also for like bands could just tape every rehearsal.
Yeah.
And listen back to it. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but before then you would have a rehearsal, and if like an improvised thing became something you wanted to make into a song, you'd have to hope you remembered what you played.
Yeah.
Because there's no other way to, before tapes, there was really no other way to record your, you know, something that kind of casual, because who wants to spend a bunch of money on a reel-to-reel machine to tape all your practices? That's just going to be prohibitive and also not really that feasible technically. And so, yeah, so I think that was a huge thing for all bands at the time. I think it also, because they got so used to listening to themselves that way, I think some of them went into studios and were like, I don't want it this clear. I wanted to have some of that tape aesthetic, you know, that grit and grime and hiss and stuff, because that's the kind of music I'm making. My music sounds like tape hiss in a way, you know. Even Sonic Youth, I'm sure, would have thought that at one point. So I think it had this kind of neat double effect, where it was making things convenient and easier and giving them the ability to do this, but it was also sort of affecting the way they thought about music. And there's, you can also extend that into the audience side. I mean, when I was in college, REM came to my college, I think 3 of the 4 years I was there, and immediately after they played, a bootleg of the show would circulate and I'd get a tape of it. And they were one of these bands that were always playing songs that were going to be on the next record. Yeah. So then the next record would come and I'd know a bunch of the songs. And there's something so cool and personal about, like, I felt like a member of the REM club because of this, you know, which really couldn't have happened otherwise before cassettes were around. But I felt like, wow, I really know REM. I knew these songs before the record came out, only because of these cassettes that I had.
Yeah. Know? I used to buy, I realize now that it was pretty dodgy, but I would go to like, tape fairs and record fairs, and surely they would be selling bootlegs of Nirvana at the Reading Festival or whatever. So I have them all, like, and I probably paid like $20 for this sort of shoddy recording, but I felt like so connected. And like you say, I felt like I was part of an experience. I was obviously not part of the experience when it happened, but I felt part of it all of a sudden. And they would play new songs, or they would experiment. And that's, you could chart the evolution of a song before it got to a record. I just, again, I think we take these little platforms for granted. And I read your book thinking, I've really taken cassettes for granted. Like, I really took it for granted that I had access to this, that I would make people I had a crush on a tape, a mixtape. And I guess I just didn't think about how lucky I was. Do you think generationally, maybe we take some of these formats for granted as they sort of ebb and flow in terms of their popularity?
Oh, for sure. I mean, we, especially in the West, I think we have a really good capacity to memory whole stuff as soon as it's gone. And so we adjust to the new thing so quickly that we forget what we didn't have before. I mean, it's still, even though I experienced it, it still kind of boggles my mind to think before cassettes came along, I didn't listen to the music that I owned, quote unquote, outside of my house.
Yeah.
I listened to the radio, But that was pretty much it. Yeah. I wouldn't drive around listening to the music that I had picked. I wouldn't, you know, take it down the street or whatever. I might bring a record to a friend's house, but that's then the extent of it. And that is completely bizarre to think about now, the idea that your music was only located in your house. I mean, I think if I told my kids that, they wouldn't even begin to comprehend what I'm talking about.
But yeah. Is there any chance that has relegated music to background noise? The same, like, for you're sure. Absolutely correct. Like, I had a Walkman and I would mm-hmm. walk around with it, soundtracked by music all the time. And mm-hmm. now I feel like I had this conversation with Douglas McCombs somewhat recently mm-hmm. when he was on the show. We were talking, I was telling him that I was listening to his album by reading a book, while reading a book. And he mm-hmm. said, oh, I couldn't do that. If I can only do one of those at once, I can't do both things. Uh-huh. And as you may know, Mark, on the show, I often say to guests, like, I was listening to your album while I was making the kids breakfast, or I was listening right. to your album while I was doing the dishes. Uh-huh. And I am now uh-huh. in this mindset where I grew up with a Walkman, so I just was so used to having music with me everywhere. And now uh-huh. it is with everyone everywhere. And it seems also like it's not taken seriously as, again, I might uh-huh. sound like an old man here. But, like, there is something to people sitting at home and just listening to a record. I don't mean an LP, but, like, maybe we focused in more on the mm-hmm. on the creative work by not being distracted by it was just on while I was doing something else. Music has right. always been this way since I've come up. I mean, it's always been portable, and mm-hmm. I never really thought about the implications of that. Do you think there are implications mm-hmm. of that? Am I overblowing this? That
I think it's totally fair. I mean, I think the kind of great and fascinating thing about all these formats and all these changes is there's no like completely positive or completely negative. There's definitely things that you lose in every change like this and are worth thinking about. I mean, you know, and people questioned it right away. When people were walking around with Walkmans, a lot of people were like, that's a weird way to listen to music. It's also a weird way to exist in the world. You're basically, it's sort of like the equivalent of taking the music in your house and putting it on your head and saying, this is what I'm doing now. Don't talk to me. Don't, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's a little goofy to be super reactionary about that, but I do think that there's a point to be made for that. I mean, it did kind of usher in this idea that you could kind of have your personal space everywhere, which is a little odd for society.
What are these telephones and these AirPods right. and headphones? Like, they're uh-huh. the Walkman of uh-huh. now. They are just yeah. the Walkman, but absolutely. everyone seems to have one now, and it uh-huh. does create. You're absolutely correct. It creates a little bit of insularity. Oh, that person's mm-hmm. not even paying attention to the traffic. They're not paying attention to anything. I surely can't talk right. to them. Like, it is kind of a don't talk. I mean, I think, sorry, right. this was true of me as a kid, too. If I was on a bus or something with my headphones mm-hmm. on, I'm guessing people wouldn't have tried to be like, Vish, hey, Vish,
right.
you know, what's going on? It was sort of like, leave mm-hmm. me alone. Anyway, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying society and civility are crumbling. Was the cassette tape a contributing factor? Can you speak to this? I think it connected yes. us and galvanized us, but it has led us uh-huh. all to think that we should have all of our entertainment with us at all times right. on the yes. tiny little screens and in lower fidelity quality on some level. Uh-huh. Anyway, I don't know what it means, but yeah. I do think cassettes and Walkmans and portability is the it is. That's ground zero for where we're all at consuming. Would you agree?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's why it is kind of an interesting subject, is that I don't think people associate cassettes with that big a kind of groundswell change, but they did really change a lot of the way we think about what our music collection is and what our music taste is and how it's an extension of our personality yeah. and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, again, it's sort of cost benefit. Like, I do think that there are some things that we've lost by not sitting down as often and just concentrating on music, or by not even having your friends come over and put a record on. That was pretty awesome. And you can still do that, but it's definitely less frequent now. At the same time, you know, I mean, you and I probably wouldn't be able to do as much as we do if we couldn't listen to music when we're making breakfast or, you know,
absolutely.
We get a lot more in that way. We experience a lot more and we're, you know, I don't want to make it sound like we're better because of this, but we're also attentive listeners in general. We're doing yeah. it because we want to pay attention. So yeah. we're not really letting it slip into the background so much. It's more like our day is the background and the music is the foreground.
Well, I do think that
not everybody does that.
Yeah. And I do think that sort of subconscious listening permeates my mind Like I don't, I as you can tell, as I sputter on here today, I don't have a lot of notes when I'm talking to people other than maybe the odd lyrical fragment. And it forces my brain to be like, access your guest songs that stuck out to you, like access something. And I'm in the moment trying to do that. And I mean, conversely to what I was just saying, I know the words to entire Wu-Tang Clan albums because that was the tape I left in the car that summer in 1994, 1995. And I just, I was like, no, this is it. This is the summer of Liquid Swords, or the summer of Enter the Wu-Tang. That is a direct result of that portability, that technology's ability to be like, what are there? I don't know about you, Mike. I inherited my parents' car, but it used to just be tapes everywhere, just tapes, and I would just grab whatever. But there were summers where I'm like, this is Wu-Tang summer, and that has stuck with me. So yes, to your point, sometimes that portability leads to more concentrated listening. Even if you're driving and you're not fully attentive, it's getting in there. So I'm just want to contradict what I was saying earlier and suggest it might actually, all this portability might be creating heightened awareness of the music in its own slow burning way. So I'll say that.
You know, there's an irony to that I just sort of noticed just recently, is that, you know, tape players stopped being put into cars, and eventually now, like, we bought a used Kia from like 2018 Kia. It doesn't have any ability to play any physical media. It's just, you can plug your phone
in. Oh no.
There's no CD player. There's no tape player. And so if I forget my phone, or if one of my kids wants to use my phone or whatever, I'm just subjected to the radio at that point, which I love radio, but it's funny that the physical format would, if there was a tape player or a CD player there, I'd have more freedom to listen to what I want to than this thing that only accepts the high end digital phone, you know, what's considered the most forward looking technology of listening to music. That's the only way you can listen to music in there. It's weird.
Well, and again, I think this speaks to the status that actual music and physical media, it's just as a very low status in all of these contemporary companies' minds. And it's vaguely classist. It's weird. I kept all my CDs and it is a very bizarre situation. And I don't, meanwhile, in your book, you have people traveling all the way to Syria because of their obsession with cassettes, and they're collecting these and they're discovering music. Like, this is a whole culture I didn't really know about, of people just, sorry, I don't want to, can you explain and maybe summarize what I'm talking about, this notion of people going to, basically they become so obsessed with tape and tape culture that they go to bazaars and they just ask for like the shittiest looking tape, and then that's their sound. Like, what is going on? What's that meant? Can you explain that and what that mentality might be all about?
Sure. Yeah. And a little bit background there. So cassette culture in non-Western countries was in a way more impactful than it was in America and Canada and UK and things like that, because so much music got recorded on cassettes that wasn't getting recorded on any other format because of either the state media saying it's not appropriate or record labels not being willing to support it or whatever. So that's a rich, super big history. It's part of the cassette history that, you know, and a couple books, there's a book on cassette culture in North India by Peter Manuel that's really good on that. There's a recent one by Andrew Simon on cassettes in Egypt that's really good at about that culture. And when I wanted to write about this, I'm like, well, I mean, those guys both lived in those countries in order to write those books. So my sort of only option was to kind of have this story told through the people who go over there and do find the cassettes. So, you know, and many of them have brought the music back here and released it in whatever ways they can, with hopefully getting whatever approval they can, or getting remuneration to the artists and things. So you've got Sublime Frequencies and Awesome Tapes from Africa, Sahel Sounds. All the guys behind those labels are definitely people who are obsessed with going up and digging up these cassettes from all these different countries, who in the 80s and 90s, they were ubiquitous. You go out on the street and there'd be kiosks full of cassettes of people who, you know, only perform their music at weddings, like Omar Suleiman, or, you know, or people who only recorded it. Some people didn't even know, you know, it was bootlegged. Like Brian from Awesome Tapes from Africa has tracked down some people with tapes he's found, and they're like, I didn't know my music got released on tape, which is pretty wild. But anyway, in a lot of ways, it represents, you know, whole regional styles, or whole kind of aesthetics that didn't get any other kind of release or popularity or publicity. And so the cassettes were sort of this weird living archive of music that otherwise wouldn't be around.
And you invoked weddings there. And as I recall in your book, like, people would record the bands or the artists playing at the wedding and bootleg that specific wedding's recording. Is that correct?
That's the impression I get. Yeah, there would be there. And also the artists sometimes would use these as their kind of their calling cards. You know, they'd record themselves at the wedding and then
at the wedding.
At the wedding like, and then put it out
live with albums, their numbers. Like, yeah.
But that was sort of or to get more wedding work. Would be the way why they would make cassettes, but then other people got into the music and would bootleg it and pass it around, and yeah, it would be from actual specific weddings, which is pretty wild.
There's a certain level of desperation in that narrative, right? It's people, the listening audience, so desperate to hear this kind of music that they're buying someone else's wedding tape, which here would just seem I would argue that would seem strange. If you were like, hey, the remember the band that played your wedding? They did all those cover songs? That was recorded and it's circulating. It's a huge hit. I'd be like, what? How did that work? Like, I didn't own the songs, but that's weird. So, like, there's something going on culturally there, but also maybe some level of it's savviness, but maybe some level of desperation on behalf of the artists as well. Like, while I'm playing, I might as well, I'll record this, or can you record this for me and we'll sell it? Am I right? Is there the cassette is like a lifeline for everyone involved in that
circle? I think that's fair to say. Yeah, for sure. I mean, like I said, there's sort of mixed uses here. Some of them are really strictly just using them as demos to get more wedding work, but some of them were like, this is my only kind of expression of my art at this point is when I perform these songs at weddings. And so the only way to kind of pass around and have sort of any kind of artistic career with what I'm doing is to sell tapes of what I've done at weddings, which is, yeah, it's funny. And before you mentioned that, I guess because I'm so familiar with Omar Suleiman and artists of his ilk that I don't think I've ever really questioned. That's a really interesting question. The fact that if that happened over here, you'd be like, what?
it would be strange.
Even back in the 80s. Yeah, it would be very strange.
You'd be buying a cassette. It would be like Bill and Marion's wedding. 2003, and you're like, what? That seems like their thing. Why should I? Anyway, that's a
strange thing. This band that only plays weddings had a particularly hot set that night, and we need to check.
I want to ask you about your own earliest interactions with cassettes, both as someone who would purchase them and also as someone who discovered that you could buy a blank tape and do what you wanted to with it, so to speak. Can you speak to those things? Do you have any sense memories of your early interactions with cassettes, both, like I say, like official things and then that recognition, like, wait a minute, if I have a blank tape, I could tape whatever I want. Can you speak to those things?
Right. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I grew up I'm about 10 years older than you. So I grew up sort of 70s and 80s. And yeah, I mean, my first interactions with tapes were, I think, just having a little handheld cassette player and holding it up to my clock radio and taping like Casey Kasem Top 40, and then try to tape over the songs I didn't like with the songs I did like, to kind of like, because it was a time where, you know, sort of the novelty-ish songs were the most interesting things, like Gary Numan or Devo. Yeah. They would manage their way into the charts. And so that was taping those and listening to those over and over again was sort of the way I figured out there was weirder music to be had than just what's in, you know, the things everybody's heard of. Getting a tape player in my car was a huge thing, especially because that pretty much coincided with the first time I could drive. Like, when I was able to drive myself to high school, I after I got a used car, the first thing I saved up for was a tape deck to put in there. And I bought a lot of pre-recorded cassettes because of that, just because it was so much easier to listen to them in the car that way. And also because at the time I didn't really, it never occurred to me that they didn't sound any, I could hear the music. That's all I cared about.
So
it was awesome to have them in the car. One of my really most distinct memories was, I guess, either double tape decks that you could dub tape to tape either didn't exist yet or were too expensive. I just remember when I was a kid not being able to get something like that. But I did have like a stereo that had the record player and the tape player all in it. And it had some RCA out things that you could put a cord in. And I knew just, you know, the most rudimentary things about that kind of thing that I figured, well, if I could somehow find another tape deck that has these same plugs, maybe I could. And I went and bought at somebody's yard sale this relatively old cassette player and hooked it up to mine. And the first thing I did was tape to another tape, and it worked. I couldn't believe it. I showed it to some of my friends, and then suddenly, like, there were a bunch of people in my school who were like, he can make a tape for you,
yeah,
of another tape. And I almost remember feeling like I had cracked a code of some sort, you know, even though probably within a year or maybe even months of me doing that, there were double tape decks that were easily accessible. But it was still this kind of neat discovery to make. It added to this. The whole thing just felt so kind of both DIY and somewhat illicit, like probably somebody doesn't want me to be doing this, which made it more fun.
What was the slogan? Home taping is killing music, that emerged in the
that's right
in the 60s, yeah, or 70s. I can't remember when it came out.
I think it started in the late 60s.
Yeah.
They tried all different versions of the kind of trying to scare people out of using tapes that way, or shame them into, because they really had no other recourse. I mean, they tried a lot of different things, but nothing ever stuck.
Earlier, I was talking about how the telephone and ear pods and whatnot, mm-hmm, is the logical extension of the more, I don't know, pioneering Walkman headphones sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You had the exact same impulse as a kid that I ended up having, uh-huh, which was, I really like this. I listen to the radio incessantly. And when you listen to any kind of radio, college, even, well, at that time it would have been probably whatever, AM, FM radio for me, mm-hmm, they play the same, the song you like is going to get played a few times a day. And right, eventually, when you figure out, my parents had a tape deck where you put a tape in, you have the radio going, you press record, it's going to grab the radio signal. You'll record what's on the radio. What about the notion that cassettes are the maybe earliest onset of the on-demand mindset? I'm not going to wait for a song to come my way. I'm, mm-hmm, going to grab it now and, mm-hmm, play it whenever I want. Do you think there's something, right, in terms of where we're at now, in terms of everything you want to watch or see or listen to, whatever, you're not waiting for commercials. You're not waiting for it to be on the broadcast schedule. You just can say, I want to hear this song. Phone, mm-hmm, play me the song. That created a little bit of a monster, I wonder, yeah, a little bit, like the fact that I, as a kid, was like, yeah, I'm not waiting through all, I'm going to, if they're playing Los Lobos La Bamba, I'm, mm-hmm, recording it now because I really like this, mm-hmm, version of La Bamba, and I don't, uh-huh, know who Richie Valens is, whatever. And I'm going to record, mm-hmm, it, and I'm just going to listen to whatever I want. Do you think oh, it, yeah, did something to us? It did, right? Okay.
Oh, 100%. Totally. I mean, that's where that all started. The concept of on-demand music-wise certainly wasn't there before cassettes, and it certainly was ubiquitous afterwards. So I think you can definitely both credit and blame the cassette for that whole thing. I mean,
did it make us more impatient, or like I'm raising two kids in this mm-hmm, landscape where they're just, if something's not working, you know, that, yeah, they're used to working, uh-huh, it's just the end, uh-huh, of the world. They don't have this notion of like, yeah, sometimes things don't work, and or you have to wait for something, right, to happen, you know, uh-huh, like they're just like, why can't we do that now? So, uh-huh, I guess I wonder if I was impatient as a radio taper, right, like I'm not going to wait, uh-huh, I'm just going to grab it. But there's a control, uh-huh, thing too with the cassette, I guess, maybe.
Right.
Is that fair?
Yeah. And I think the downside of it is that maybe it did make us all more impatient and a little bit more entitled to feel like we should get what we want whenever we want, which I don't love that about streaming. I think that something's lost in streaming. The fact that you just got everything available to you all the time is not necessarily a fully positive thing. The flip side of the positivity is the control we were taking away was away from corporate radio stations, corporate record companies, who otherwise were dictating when we're going to hear, you know, I mean, part of it is also too, not just wanting to hear that song before not having to wait for it again. It's also wanting to hear a bunch of different music rather than hearing the same song over and over like radio would do. And that was because radio had figured out, we're going to make the most money if we're repetitive as hell, you know, and that's fine if they're going to make the most money, but that's not what I want out of music. I don't want to benefit the radio station. I want to hear the music I want to hear, you know, outside of these people who are telling me what is popular. So,
yeah,
that aspect of it, the independence of it, and the fact that it was wrestling some control away from the companies is the positive aspect. But it does come with this sort of negative thing that we get a little too entitled, because I would like to feel entitled around corporations, because I you know, I'm not a big fan. I don't want to feel entitled to an artist's work. That's not necessarily a good thing.
Well, radio is an kind of came up in radio. I'm no longer in the industry. Mm-hmm. As of very recently, and mm-hmm, I worry about it a little bit. And mm-hmm, I'm not actively worried about it. I was having trouble trying to figure out who cared about this medium. This is right. The most democratic thing we have in terms of a communication signal. Ideally, mm-hmm. and like you say, they're changing the cars. I feel like, wasn't there legislation? Yeah. Like there's not even AM radio in new model cars anymore?
I have heard about that. Yeah, I've never seen that, but I have heard about that.
I've heard of it too. Yeah, I think it's newer models. They're just getting rid of, I believe it's specifically AM radio. So they're cutting off this fully democratic, like anyone can access this content kind of platform. I assume FM radio is going to, you know, I know the industry. I know that it's sort of like hard to work in these industries. Mm-hmm. They're always like every media industry, right? There's mergers and acquisitions and people lose their jobs. But it does often speak to whether or not people care anymore. I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, but I am really fixated on, from your book, the notion that particularly those people, like you said, outside the Western hemisphere, how important these tapes are as a communication tool, and whether or not we are, with each platform and or each thing we adopt, slowly killing some equity, some egalitarian platform that anyone can access. And so on the one hand, I'm really heartened that tapes have a little bit of a audience now, but it does it worry you at all that it's not this very accessible, affordable medium for artists, for labels, and for listeners? Like, does it worry you, given the trends we've seen and the cycles we've seen, that it's not as popular as it once was? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I definitely, there are definitely things that you always sort of worry about and wonder what you've lost when things decline in any way. The things that had value beyond just like economic value when they decline. Yeah, I do wish that more people were interested in cassettes and buying cassettes. And I do think that there's something not so great about the fact that it's very, very niche.
Yeah.
The flip side is, you know, it's sort of a shock that it exists at all still. So there's the positivity of the fact that it's still happening. And I think the cool thing about it is that despite the fact that we've lost it sort of as a mass medium, what's held onto it is mostly people who are using it for the value it always had.
Yeah. And
for the reasons that it was good, even though there are some major labels still putting out cassettes, which is, I think, a little ridiculous. But you know, if it keeps the duplicators in business, that's great.
I think we're so fractured. Doesn't it feel like we're so fractured that everything is kind of niche? Like, yeah, I don't know how to explain it. Like, I'm currently rewatching Better Call Saul for like, I don't know how many times I've been through this series. Like, I'm finally back into the, when I have time. But I'll talk to people like, oh, I never saw it. I'm like, how could you? This is like the greatest show I've ever seen. Like, are you crazy? Like all the multi-layers and the temporal shifts and how do they do this? Uh-huh. Like, oh, I don't have time. I don't know if anything is super popular anymore. Does that make sense?
Right. No, it does make sense. And I mean, I think there's some kind of cool things about that. I mean, I think mass media has a lot of bad tendencies and whether they're side effects or intentions of it, you know, it gets pitch to the lowest common denominator. The creative decisions get dictated by what will offend the least amount of people, all those kind of things. So there are good things that everything's niche, I think, because it gives them more freedom to be what they are rather than try to make them for, because not everything is not for everybody. And I think that's fine. Yeah. And also we find out once something is considered that it could be for everybody, it's mostly just exploited for how much money it can make. So there's good things about things being niche, but you know, we also were lucky enough to grow up in a time where we felt like we were sharing some things that everybody, you know, a shared language around, like we all knew who Michael Jackson was or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, there's good things. There's cool things about that. I mean, that had a lot to do with how we approach music. And I think it is weird that, you know, like my kids only know about like maybe 10 second snippets of songs they hear on TikTok or whatever is their experience of music. And they don't even know who the artist is necessarily. And it's all kind of weird. But, you know, I'm sure every generation has trouble understanding what the other new generation is doing. And then it works out in some ways, hopefully. So. I don't know. I rambled a little bit there.
No, you're on the right show for rambling. Didn't believe you, me. No, I appreciate that. And I think it's astute. We've alluded to various sort of aspects of this book on some level. Different chapters have been invoked. As a catch-all, in your research for this book, as you were finalizing chapters, do you have any sense, recall, of like things that you were particularly surprised by or excited by, even? I know that when you're engaged in a project like this, you stumble, sometimes you just stumble upon a narrative thread, and you're like, holy shit! And then you're so satisfied. You're so satisfied that you got to that. It feels magical. Did you have moments like that in particular, or are there moments like that that stick out for you in this book?
Yeah. There's definitely a few. I mean, one that always comes to mind is the aspect of Go-Go and how much it used tapes. I grew up in D.C. I knew about Go-Go. I had no clue that there was this tape network that was basically sustaining the whole thing. Yeah. And beyond just trading tapes, I mean, they had a sort of an ecosystem where they actually had stores that you could go and buy bands' shows, have them dubbed on cassette for you, and they called them PA tapes. And getting into that was really interesting. And I did not know how crucial tapes have been to Go-Go, even though I knew about Go-Go. So that was really cool. I think with a lot of the stories of both bootlegging and digging for tapes around the world, there's just all sorts of neat stories that I had no idea that I wouldn't have found out about if I hadn't been lucky enough to research this book. I mean, all the different, I mean, like the Grateful Dead subculture, which is very well known about. I mean, everybody knows about Dead Tapers and Deadheads, and I still learned a lot more than I thought I would digging into that, just about the way people went about it, how much people did, how social it became, how much it became a way that people connected more, so, even more so maybe than going to the shows, was trading the tapes was just such a social connection for so many people.
Yeah, and the fact that I really found it fascinating, and spoiler alert for those who haven't read the book, that the band initially resisted the notion that people would be taping it, and then pretty much couldn't have adopted it more, like designated areas and for people to bring in their equipment so they weren't, you know, viewed as scofflaws by security. I don't know if there's a sort of modern parallel to that, but they really were pioneers in terms of realizing that people sharing the tapes actually was a I'm sorry, I don't think this was articulated as such in your book, but I think at some point someone in the band or the organization of the band realized it was a savvy marketing move.
For sure. Yeah.
Is that fair?
Definitely. I mean, there's I do have some quotes from them that I found that basically sort of maybe don't say it explicitly, but pretty much implicitly, like, what our two options here are being cops about this or not. And, you know, smartly, that's not what they wanted to be. And it dovetailed really well with the fact that this was going to help them anyway. But especially when they had that gap when they weren't playing for a while, people just traded tapes and they actually got more fans during their hiatus than they had before they stopped.
Yeah. Was that attributed to Mickey Hart? Is that who said that? I can't remember. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the band had this recognition of what was going on. And if you look at their trajectory, like, I can't keep track of it. Every few years, the Dead or the Dead and Company stop playing, announce they're going to play a final show. Sorry if I sound cynical, but then they don't seem to do it. Or like some of them go, okay, we're done this. We're going to do a spinoff. And then everyone else like, oh, I want to be part of the spin. Anyway, I'm being very cynical, but that tape culture, is probably why when they do these like final tours, it's not a club. They're playing baseball stadiums in major cities. Like, it's, if you see the footage, you're like, holy shit. How is this band this popular in America still?
Yeah,
I don't know. I would attribute it a lot to what you talk about in this book, this fact that they created around the cassette in particular, a true social network among their fans who were encouraged to trade tapes, become friends with each other.
Right.
You can be as cynical as you want. That's quite interesting, even if it's a business savvy move, but it seems to have sustained interest in this band who I barely have. But the last time they had a big song in the charts was like 1989.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Anyway, it's a testament to, I think, this medium maybe.
Yeah,
I know. No, sorry, I should say that, and you acknowledge it. People started to go digital with their tape trading, right? But it emanates from the tape.
It does.
And you've got these people in this book creating these like exhibits of every concert they can find. Like these artists, like creating these like beautiful. I don't know. It's just sorry. It's just mm-hmm. it's very fascinating. And again, I feel like an ass for taking it for granted, but mm-hmm. I'm also old enough to see the cycles we go through where
sure.
certain platforms are in vogue and then they're not mm-hmm. in vogue or right. They get co-opted. So mm-hmm. given your knowledge of such cycles, Mark, I hate to put you on the spot and ask you for grand predictions, but, and you know, I've watched you on Twitter engaging with this bizarre situation happening with Bandcamp. Mm-hmm. And as they are absorbed by yet another party that is probably mm-hmm. going to alter the business model. Do you have predictions about, given where we're at right now, whether it's with cassettes, records, digital streaming, whatever, do you have a sense of what's probably coming next? Like, I keep seeing articles like, CDs are back
right.
every couple of months. And I see yeah. the same sentence, you know, by the time of the end of the book, you get sort of tape experts saying, oh, these fucking media companies keep saying the resurgence of tapes. It's right. so stupid. Like, they never went anywhere. Sorry, I'm not going to ask you to do that. What do you think is going to happen next in terms of how we consume music and what might get, you know, pop up as being like the thing to use, so to speak?
Right, right. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, I think you and I probably share this. The first thing I think of when I try to think of what's going to happen next is I expect the worst. The last past few years have made it that even more likely to that you'd expect the worst. You can sort of imagine that everything's just going to be sucked up by people who don't care that much about music and tech people or whatever. And so it's hard to be super optimistic about it. But I do think that, and the cassette is a symbol of this, that the kind of outside cultures that take advantage of things in a DIY way and do it outside of anybody like giving them a lot of money for it or giving them a lot of publicity or approval, that's always going to exist in some form. So hopefully there will be new ways to do that. I mean, when the internet first came along, as you mentioned, like when people were trading digital files of the Grateful Dead or Fish or whoever, there was a really rich culture of people using the internet for this that was not, no VC came in and said, I'm going to make a platform for you guys to trade. They were just doing it in whatever ways they could find that, you know, and then once it gets bigger, it gets kind of sucked up, unfortunately. But I think there's always going to be room for that kind of thing to happen. How it'll manifest, that is always a tough thing
yeah.
to imagine. I mean, you know, for a while there's tapes in other countries outside of the West got replaced by like SIM cards, you know.
Yeah.
People would trade music on SIM cards, which is sort of hard to imagine ever happening here. So yeah. something like that, you know, with whatever technology we have next in terms of our communication, someone's going to figure out some way to sort of hack's the wrong word and to sort of a techie word, but to kind of utilize it in ways people didn't intend it to. Because ultimately, the cassette was not necessarily intended to be what it became. I think that's the beauty of both kind of communities who are based around music fandom and artists themselves, is they're always finding ways to take advantage of formats in ways that other people did not intend them for at all. In fact, probably don't want them to happen. I think that'll always be around. So that's kind of a vague prediction. But.
It is funny. The compact cassette tape is invented for whatever purpose it's invented for. And sooner rather than later, people figured out ways that they could Bogart music. And, right. and so the music industry tends to go after the consumer, not mm-hmm. the creator of the platform right. that actually, that's not exactly true. Were there not levies on blank tapes and things? And
right, there was a conflict between the record makers, the music industry, and the tape makers in some senses, for sure. Like they were kind of, which is weird because you think of them as all one thing, you know?
Yeah, but music itself or creativity, like movies, films, they're going to exist in some right. way. I know, we're both pretty cynical people. Let's face it, Mark. But I think we yes. can optimistically suggest, and that's the only way I can look at these things as I see venues mm-hmm. closing and artists struggling to make money with streaming services, is they're like, but mm-hmm. I'm going to keep doing it. Right. And I'll play house shows if I have to. And mm-hmm. I'll only sell my music on, well, for now, we'll say Bandcamp. That's the only thing right. I can think of to do. So there's mm-hmm. a weird perseverance in creative compulsion mm-hmm. that means these cycles are going to continue and you and I are going to be overjoyed by certain developments and infuriated by the same sorts of developments over and over right. and over again. That's all I got in terms of optimism. Is that people seemed
I would add that the at least here, I'm not sure how much this is happening in Canada, but at least here there's reason for optimism in the way so many people are unionizing in so many different fields.
Yeah.
And there's a Bandcamp union, which is hopefully going to help ameliorate, I guess that's what ameliorate or alleviate any big damage that might happen from this latest sale. And also ultimately, I hope that maybe, and this may be way too optimistic, but that whole kind of union drive and the tendency toward people wanting to unionize will also eventually translate into people wanting to sort of own the means of production.
Yeah.
if for a cliche, you know, maybe band camps can be started by bands and artists. I mean, it's not easy. Someone has to step up and take a lot of time and probably a lot of money, but hopefully we could start to see more, you know, worker owned versions of band camp where we're not, they're not subjected to the whims of, oh, hey, I'm just going to sell this to somebody who doesn't give a crap about music.
Yeah. Well, it's a, like I say, that is a hopeful point of view, and I hope you're correct.
I hope so, too.
This book is great. Can you tell folks, first of all, where they can learn more about High Bias, the distorted history of the cassette tape? And also, I know, speaking of Bandcamp, I feel like you created a little product to go along with the book.
I did.
Can you talk about those things?
Sure. So sort of the bigger picture thing is it's available wherever you buy books, and it's on University of North Carolina Press. You can get it from them or from all the online booksellers and stuff. But I also do have a Bandcamp page where you can buy the book from me and I'll sign it for you. And also I made a cassette release of my own called High Bias Music from the Book, which in my last chapter, I talk about current tape labels that I find interesting and significant. And I reached out to a lot of them, and they each, 12 of them gave me tracks from their catalog, and so it's a compilation of some of these new tape labels and artists who are recording on tape, and so you could buy those together, you could just get the tape, you could even download, you just buy the digital version of the tape if you want, although I think the tape is cool because it's got the same exact cover as the book, just a little bit different writing on it, and it looks kind of like a mini version of the book.
Nice.
So yeah, so highbiasbook.bandcamp.com is where all that is.
Okay, cool. And if people want to follow you and keep tabs on your potential live appearances for the book and whatnot, where would you like to send them?
I'm probably go to uncpress.org and look at their blog. That's where they list all my events. I'll also be, you know, putting them out on my social media on Instagram and Twitter, which I do go as at Marcissist, so like narcissist with an M instead of an N. but who knows how long any of us will be on all those platforms, so those aren't necessarily most reliable. It's probably worth going to uncpress.org to find the most reliable information about where I'll be. I'm going to be on the East Coast in a couple weeks doing some events, so you'll find that information there.
It's true. As we're speaking, those platforms exist, but by the time people hear this, who knows? Who knows if that's actually the case? Well, exactly. As I say, it's a really compelling and remarkable book, and it just flooded me with so many feelings and memories. And I maybe alluded to earlier, I'm a little detached from this medium. I tell you what, I'm going to figure out a way to get myself a double tape deck. I'm going to go all out. And I was looking into it once when we first moved, but I just never did anything about it. But you got me convinced. I need to start listening to at least my old mixtapes and the gifts I received from people in my past who were like, and I didn't, you know, I'm so stupid. I didn't realize how nice people were being. I just was like, oh, thanks a lot. And I realized, then you listen now, you're like, oh, a lot of cutesy songs on this thing. I should have been paying more attention. I feel like an asshole. So anyway, all this to say, I need to revisit my past a little bit and I'm going to order your tape. I'm curious about this as well.
Great.
So,
well, I've made a habit of going to Goodwill, which is the kind of the thrift store in America. And every time I see a double tape deck, I usually grab it if it's less than $20. So I have a couple extras. I'd be happy to send you one.
Oh, really? Well,
if you're really serious about it, I'd be happy to do that.
We have a Value Village, which is an equivalent sort of thrift chain. Yep. And we have a Goodwill in Edmonton. So that's a good call. Maybe I'll go there as opposed to a hi-fi audio store and pick one up.
The old ones still work great.
Yeah. Or maybe I should get my parents. Anyway, this is none of anyone's concern. I'll figure this out. Mark, Mark, it was really nice to connect. I don't think we've ever actually spoken. So thank you for this time.
Yeah.
And I hope you enjoyed yourself. And as I always say, I wish you the best luck in the future. And I hope we talk soon.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, no, I really had a great time. One of the things I was thinking of when the book started to come out is like, if there's any way I can talk to you about it, that would be one of my dreams. So I'm really happy that we were able to do that.
Oh, that's so nice and meaningful. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Very lovely to speak with Mark Masters. Thank you again, Mark, for being on this, the 813th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available just about wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, which I'm several months behind on, I'm sorry, please visit vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on things like Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. I'm also on Blue Sky and Threads and Mastodon and Hive, I think, still. I'm on all the things that emerged in recent months, and I use them as sparingly as I can. But if you want to find me on, I'm on Facebook, you can find me on things and follow me or ask to follow me or whatever it takes. Thank you. I'll do the same. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to support the work that goes on with this podcast with your dollars. $6 American or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, and you get episodes earlier than everybody else. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt for your generosity, I will send you one. Just message me on Patreon. We'll figure out your size and the color and design you like. And if I've got them in stock, you get one. That's how it works. So again, thanks for supporting this show on Patreon. Speaking of thanks, I want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. Each independent businesses who offer in-kind support for this show. I can't thank them enough. Also want to thank Jim Guthrie. He has provided some music for me to use for this show, and you can learn more about Jim and his amazing catalog of song at jimguthrie.org. And I want to thank Mark Masters for being on this show, and to you for listening to our conversation. I hope you will check out his book, High Bias. It is amazing and fascinating. I hope you were enthralled and interested and intrigued by our conversation about it, and that compels you to pick up the book. It's really something else. And I was just, as I said to Mark there, it's nice for us to finally connect after having this little bit of long distance affection for one another. So thank you, Mark. Thank you all for listening to this. I hope you're well. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast or follow it and support the show and tell your friends about it. And that's all I got. I will talk to you soon. Be well. Bye for now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.